From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1824 in Philadelphia's Eastern State Penitentiary. It was a brand new prison at the time, considered to be a model of how prisons should be designed. Why? Well, because every single prisoner would be kept in solitary confinement for the entirety of his or her term. Each prisoner had a windowless cell, and at the time, this was considered to be more humane than other potential punishments, because it would give prisoners time and space to consider their crimes and to determine to live better lives upon release. And that's what brings us to 1824, when the Marquis de Lafayette visited that prison. Lafayette had, of course, fought on the American side during the Revolutionary War. Now he was back to see how this new country was developing. And when he saw the prison, he was horrified. Lafayette told prison officials that it was torture, that he himself had been placed in solitary confinement after the French Revolution. Lafayette counseled American leaders to stop using what is often known as the hole. Well, you know, of course, that didn't happen. A study released by Yale Law School estimates that on any given day, between 80,000 and 100,000 inmates are held in isolation cells nationwide. In some states, inmates are held in single cells for decades without end. But in recent years, there have been efforts to reduce the number of prisoners held in solitary confinement. Governor Andrew Cuomo agreed to a process designed to set limits on the time that inmates spend in isolation. And the New York Civil Liberties Union says the number of men and women in isolation has dropped by more than 25% in the state rather quickly. Changes are happening elsewhere, too, both at the state and potentially the federal level. But here in New York, some have pushed back. The New York State Correctional Officers and the Police Benevolent Association have emphasized violent incidents in which inmates assault staff. In other words, they're defending solitary confinement as a necessary tool to either correct, penalize, or deter. While the ROC Acts Criminal Justice Task Force is working with the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement. And for the next 5 days in Rochester, they're showing a replica solitary confinement cell to the public. The idea is for members of our community to experience solitary firsthand. And they are here with us on Connections today. We want to make clear we reached out to the Department of Corrections and to New York State. Our invitations to join this discussion were declined. But in studio, we have Jerome Wright, who is an activist. He's a solitary confinement survivor, and he is the upstate organizer for the campaign we just talked about. Jerome, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Appreciate it.
Back on the program with us is Pastor Matthew Martin Nikoloff from the South Wedge Mission. Pastor, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And Pastor Scott Austin is here from Artisan Church. Pastor, welcome to you as well.
Thanks, Evan.
I also want to make clear that this is not an effort to sort of create an imbalanced conversation. We can only have conversations with people who are willing to be here. So I want to make clear, if you have different opinions, you can share them this hour. We want to hear from you. And I also want to, we will get to some of the comments from the unions that have pushed back. We'll have those for you as well this hour. But let me start with Jerome, who is the upstate organizer for this campaign. Why now? Why is this effort underway? Some would say, look, New York State has joined a growing list of states that have tried to reduce the number of people in confinement and solitary confinement and the length of time. Is that already a good direction, or do we need to see something more dramatic?
Well, it's definitely a good direction. I would be remiss in not saying that there have been some minor, and I emphasize very minor reforms, but the torture that's inherent in this solitary confinement issue is something that needs to be dealt with now. The incremental changes are not going to be enough to save the lives and minds of the people that this is impacting. It's not.
How long were you in solitary confinement?
Well, over the length of my incarceration, which spanned 3 decades, I spent an aggregate amount of 7 years in solitary confinement, and for any one individual time, it was the longest stay was 2.5 years.
All right, we're going to get back to his personal story there in just a moment. I think it will help illustrate what exactly we're talking about here. Pastor Scott Austin from Artisan Church, why are you and your church involved, and tell us what's coming up this weekend as well with that.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of thing that has become important to us over the life of our church. Being concerned with racial reconciliation, and of course this is not an issue that affects everybody proportionally. And we have an event coming up on Saturday called Rethinking Incarceration with an author, Dominique Du Bois-Gilliard, whose book addresses not only the broad societal problem, but in particular the role of Western Christian theology in perpetuating mass incarceration and unjust kind of punishment. So that event will have a special musical guest, Daniel Ponder, who, of course, is active in this conversation locally as well, and a conversation with the author, books for sale, and all those things.
What time on Saturday?
6 p.m. at Artisan Church, which is 1235 South Clinton Ave.
All right, 6 p.m. on Saturday. And when you talk about Christian theology's role in all of this, that can be occasionally a little uncomfortable for people to kind of grapple with. How do you view, I mean, look, we could be here for hours, and I understand that. Yeah. But let me just start with the kind of the broad outlines of how you view Christian theology's role in that.
Yeah, it's a little hard to get into without kind of going to some pretty inside baseball, but I'll do what I can. I think the most important thing to understand is that the way Christians think about how salvation occurs, you know, every Christian would say Jesus saves us from our sins, but how does that happen? And for many evangelical Christians in particular, the prevailing description for that, we would use the term a theory of atonement, how are our sins atoned for, is that Jesus bears the wrath of God, takes the punishment in our place, and it's in the act of being punished that he saves us from our sins. And so you can see that punishment itself becomes the source of salvation with that kind of a model. And this book argues for a different view of atonement that allows for a justice that is restorative rather than retributive. And that's, again, it's that maybe is of particular interest to religious people, especially to Christian people. But I think it's hard to separate that from American history, of course.
Yeah, and I think I just want to make sure I understand, Pastor. I certainly understand the idea of atonement and that view of sort of salvation. Is that to then say that as we created a prison model, that sort of mindset moved in there, that there must be atonement, there must be punishment, and that is perfectly appropriate because it comes directly from our divine inspiration?
Yes, and you can trace the history of corrections in prisons in America, and you can kind of trace American Christian history through that as well. And some of that is outlined in Dominique's book. It starts with the Puritans. It affects the early programs of having chaplains in prisons. And it's perpetuated nowadays by a evangelical Christian population that, broadly speaking, is very oriented toward law and order and continues to see because of their theological commitments, continues to see punishment as in some way affecting salvation. And that's the way that criminals are going to be reformed is by punishing them more harshly.
We know, listeners, by the way, that viewpoint generally it just does not work. There's a lot of research. We have a very poor track record in this country for we have higher rates of recidivism than perhaps with other models that could be employed. And it's not a very good track record. I mean, that's just something that has been studied, and we're happy to cite research if you want on that. I want to turn to Pastor Matthew Martin Nicolaw from the South Wedge Mission. Again, we could talk about theology on this all day, and I think we should talk a little bit more about it. But let me first ask you about the replica cell, because the community can experience it. Tell me about it.
Absolutely. Well, it's horrific. It's about the size of a small bathroom. And in addition to having a replica of a bathroom within it, there's a soundtrack playing in the background that includes actual recordings from within prisons where solitary confinement is practiced. And one person thought that they were whale sounds. What did you thought there was the sounds of elephants outside the building?
It was sort of a shrieking.
You didn't realize it was from within the cell when you were just over there. But it's not to make light of it. It really is visceral. It's not just something you experience with your mind, but with your whole body, to place yourself in solidarity with people who are experiencing that. And even then, you know you're getting out in a few minutes. But to actually be in there, I was joking with some friends this morning. I got to church early and decided to meditate in the cell with the door closed, because a lot of friends of mine who have gone to prison have used the solitude as an opportunity to develop a contemplative practice. And I said, okay, what's that like? And it was nice. You know, I didn't hear my kids screaming. I didn't hear, I didn't even hear the usual sounds of the street that I usually hear when I pray at the church. And so I was kind of like, okay, I could choose to do this for 20 minutes, not for 20 years, not for 20 hours a day. And then when our friend Michael, who's helping to organize, Michael Tome, brought the soundtrack over, I said, I didn't even want to go back in. Because you're not just in there. It's not this romanticized idea of the solitary activist contemplating the reform, the revolution when they get out.
And that was really the idea. That's why I opened the program the way we did. Because, you know, when the Marquis de Lafayette saw this prison, he was sort of horrified. But they tried to appeal to him to say, no, this gives the prisoners the chance to have that space of contemplation.
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the lies inherent in that is that we can choose for other people what their penance and or their spiritual path should be. You know, it's one thing for me to choose, even if I'm in prison, to say I will embrace this for myself as a path to solitude. It's another thing for someone who does not have a deep relationship with you, who does not have your best interest in heart, or who is outside of a prison who just says those prisoners need to be reformed and I know what's best for them, to prescribe isolation and call it some sort of, you know, conversion. It's a really sick version of conversion therapy. You need solitude and silence to somehow be converted to a better kind of person, but if it's torture and the person didn't choose it for themselves and you're imposing on them, that's spiritual violation.
All right, so I want to make sure our listeners understand, if they want to see the replica cell, if they want to go inside the replica cell of solitary confinement, they can do that from when to when and where to go.
Absolutely. So the time, there's several different blocks of time over the next few days, but that's set up at the South Wedge Mission at 125 Caroline Street. And I would say if you go to our Facebook page right after this program, you can find the times as well as on our webpage, southwedgemission.org, just because they're not random, but they're all over the place. So to list them all out now would not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So South Wedge Mission is on Facebook.
Yep.
And this afternoon they're going to have the times up there. So between now and I think, through the weekend, is that right, Pastor?
Absolutely. All the way until Monday.
All the way until Monday, you'll have a chance to experience this cell. And, you know, Jerome experienced it in a much more real way, in a continued way, again, an aggregate of 7 years over a 20-year term. And before we kind of dig a little bit into Jerome's experience, I want to listen to some comments made by Mike Powers, who was talking to NPR's Brian Mann and representing some of the guards and some of the prison workers who have pushed back, saying that they believe solitary confinement is vital, that it must be there as a deterrent, that it must be there as sort of occasionally punitive, and that it serves its effect because there are violent incidents and that we have to be concerned about this. So let's listen to what Mike Powers told NPR.
Creating dire circumstances and unhealthy environments, basically giving the inmate population a more brazen attitude and recognizing that consequences aren't what they used to be.
He's saying it's making it more dangerous to remove solitary confinement. In other words, you know, the population is more brazen. So let's go back around the table, and I'll start with Pastor Nikoloff. When you hear him say the prison population is more brazen because they know there's less of a chance they're going to end up in solitary confinement and that there is more violence as a result, do you believe that? Does that matter?
I think people are often going to do what they're going to do no matter what, and that regardless of the nature of the threat, people will often, when they're pressed into unhealthy situations, when they're pressed into a corner, when they are imprisoned and treated under often oppressive and racist conditions, you know, any threat is the same at that point. And having solitary versus something else won't deter it. But having solitary as an option, which is a form of torture, if we say, well, they should get waterboarding because they have been bad, that'll deter them. We would be up in arms about waterboarding or Chinese water torture as a method of deterrency. So the guards can find, I believe that with the right dialogue and conversation and the right study, we can find other methods of deterrence that don't involve forms of torture.
Okay. Pastor, what do you think?
Well, my father was a police officer and a corrections officer. My brother-in-law is a state trooper in New York. My uncle has been in law enforcement his entire career, and so I know the fear that, frankly, that comes with loving someone who goes out and puts their life on the line in this kind of job. I have unfathomable respect for people in these roles and for the risks that they take. But I think it's important to find solutions that don't involve something that equates really to torture. And the problem with that is it's much easier and simpler and probably less costly to put someone in the SHU than it is to do the kind of restorative work that would address the problem more permanently.
Do you think that Mike Powers, who represents that union, talking to NPR, do you think he's making an argument in good faith? In other words, do you think he truly believes that this is a safety issue and that it is necessary?
I imagine he does. I don't have any reason to think otherwise. I don't know. I've of course never met him.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, I can easily imagine my uncle or my father making a similar argument. But my life has been changed by being exposed to other sides of this conversation, and that's the kind of thing that you can't undo.
I mentioned earlier that Jerome Wright, who is the upstate organizer for the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement, is also someone who was in solitary confinement himself. And Jerome has said you're kind of an open book.
So yeah.
You were incarcerated for 20 years?
For 29 years, 10 months, 1 day, 3 hours, and 37 seconds to be exact. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What were you incarcerated for?
For murder. Yeah, I'm originally from New York City, and when I was 18 years old, I was involved with a group of guys involved in a drug transaction that went awry, and somebody was killed, and I was involved in that. I'm not minimizing my involvement at all. It's something that I deeply regret. I'm not just pinning it on my youth, but it was definitely a serious blight on my youthful years and caused me to have to go to prison for that amount of time, yes.
Okay. And you ended up spending, again, a total of 7 years in solitary confinement. What was the longest you spent at any given time in solitary?
2.5 years out of a 5-year adjudication. I was supposed to do 5 years in solitary for supposedly assaulting staff, like Mr. Powers would say, and was given 5 years. And then after the investigation happened, it was proved that I didn't assault anybody, that I was assaulted, and that the officers were sanctioned, that I was released of at a time cut, not exonerated, but released halfway through that adjudication of 5 years. Before you say, I wanted to say something about the response from Mike Powers and what the officers' union said. There's unequivocal evidence that every place in the world, not just in the United States, that they have changed the paradigm of punishment from solitary confinement to more humane alternatives. Every place, there have been a precipitous change in the amount of violence in the facility, whether it be inmates or staff. The staff in every one of these jurisdictions have said, some of them who were initially reticent about it, that it makes the environment safer and better. I'm not saying this. This is people who have changed it in their other states and localities, and they say this.
I want to ask you why you think it makes sense, though, because having been incarcerated for as long as you have, you saw the dynamic. Mm-hmm. You saw the relationships and the tension.
Yes.
Is there a current setup that almost sparks tension between inmates and staff right now?
Yes. The way solitary is set up, where you put somebody in there and the time can be indefinite. You can put somebody in there for something that is not even an offense that you should be putting. There's a rule, and there's got to be rules, and rule breakers need to follow rules probably more than people who normally follow them. So I got no problem with this. So there's a rule that you got to have. You can have no more than 50 stamps in your possession at any given time. So say they do a random cell search and they find 75 stamps. That should not be a reason for me to go to solitary confinement. Take my stamps, take my packages, make some other adjustment to my, ability to move around the facility. But to put me in isolated confinement with the knowledge that my staying there is going to irreparably damage my mind, body, and soul, nothing but torture and abuse, nothing.
Well, you said that the 2.5 years was predicated on an assault that you say you did not commit.
I did not, yes.
So you're 2.5 years there, but that still doesn't account for another 4.5 years. So what were the other reasons they put you in the
cell? Well, I haven't, and being brutally honest, I have been separated for incidences of fights where I did involve myself, and I was the needed to be separated. But see, the paradigm, as we're saying, is separation is okay because people need to be separated at times. Isolation is never okay. We are social beings. There's a human contract that says our DNA is imprinted with the desire, the need to have interaction with each other on a meaningful level. When you take that away, then you cease to see me and I cease to feel like a human. Those sounds that he heard that he thought was a whale or an elephant, that's us going back to our base nature because we're being treated like animals. You begin to mimic the animal sounds and feelings.
What was it like the first time you went to solitary? And if you can help me understand it, Jerome, did you have a fear of solitary? Or did you think, well, everybody ends up in solitary. I'll have to do my time there. It's no big deal.
The only fear I had of solitary is what I've heard happens in there, that when you come in, if you make a perceived move, you will be taken down and assaulted, that you can be denied meals, that you can be denied recreation. So my only fear was what would happen to me while I was in there. But as far as it being a deterrent for me to do the things that I did to get me there, no, it was not. And it is not for anybody.
Okay. When you spent your first day, 3 days, a week, a month mm-hmm. there, do you remember as time went by, your mindset changing at all?
You know, looking back, you know, this is, you know, Monday night quarterbacking. I mean, I'm looking back and I don't want to sound like I'm, you know, looking back and just, like revisionist history. Like, I can honestly say I didn't think about it now at that point. At that point, my only thought was, I got to survive this, and I have to stay on my P's and Q's because things happen in solitary, and there's nobody there to tell about it or to help you. So you really got to be, you know, my senses were heightened. You know, I did feel some anxiety. I'm not going to sit here and say I was so hardcore that I didn't feel anything, but my main thing was survival and watching what was going on around me. So everything else was secondary to that. My survival was the first thing I thought about.
What is the hardest part of solitary?
The hardest part, if there is a hardest part, I would just say the fact that at some points you question your own humanity. If I'm in prison, what does that say about me? The isolation sometimes... you know, you talk to yourself, you know, the noise. I would say the worst part for somebody going for the first time is going into that environment and hearing all the noise, hearing other people being abused or denied stuff, crying out for medical aid or psychiatry or medication or just crying out to be recognized that I'm still alive. Those are things that are very unnerving. It permeates your soul, like, people, you know, the empathy factor is there. You know, we're born with empathy. So I'm coming to an environment and people are hurting. I'm hurting. Before I even feel a hurt for myself, I feel their hurt and pain. And that's something to live with all day, every day.
Those are the sounds of solitary?
Oh, man. If I wish we had bought the soundtrack. And I can make sure you can get it if you want to play it on your show. You can pick it up. It is... nonstop noise and screaming and yelling and pain and suffering and emoting. You ever see, I've only been in a male prison, so I can only imagine what it's like for women or children, because we still do that to children. But this is the only time I've really seen men emote and can't help themselves from the crying, from the pain. It is torture. It is really torture. And the reason I'm talking to you now is because I probably had the best case scenario. I had a wife and family who visited every week, wrote letters all the time, made sure I had correspondence courses and classes that I took on, not online, but in there, through the mail, made sure that I was engaged with my family. So some of the issues my colleagues felt, I didn't feel. So I know that some of them couldn't read or write. I went to school with a high school education and some college. So I would read letters for other people. I would interpret stuff. So imagine being in a solitary cell
and you can't read and write. What do you have but your own mind to play tricks on you? Not like you can get a book and, like I did many a days, got a book and read it from cover to cover the same day because it took me away. But if I can't read, what am I going to do? If I can't write a letter or have nobody to write a letter to, what am I going to do? You see graffiti on the walls, and there's graffiti, somebody saying, I am here, I'm alive. And it's a reaffirmation to themselves that they're real, that they're human, that they exist still, because in that environment you feel less than human. You feel like an animal in a cage. You know, the anxiety of the situation, the denial of your rights, whether when you get mail, when you go to rec, if you go to rec, how your food comes, if you get it. There's just so many things. And I don't want to make it seem like every correction officer is abusive, but you know what? Corruption begets corruption. So people who go in there and don't have no inkling that they're going to treat somebody unfairly end up doing it because they see the bad guy doing it. And he that nobody does anything about him. Nobody stops him. Nobody says anything. So this is really big. This is a human rights issue. They want to coach it in terms of prisoners and prison rights. So you can say, well, for prisoners in prison, they belong there. Maybe this is what they need. These are human beings.
PBS recently did a lot of reporting on solitary confinement. And my understanding through their reporting is there's essentially two types or two justifications given for solitary confinement. One is disciplinary segregation, leveled as punishment when inmates break rules, such as stealing a cellmate's radio. You might get solitary for a week or two, that kind of a thing. And administrative segregation, which is used when prisoners are deemed a risk to the safety of other inmates or prison staff. That was you? That's what they decided with you? Is that right?
Well, I was in disciplinary, I was in administrative, and they have what you call protective custody, which is also a form of solitary confinement. The same rules apply. They get 1 hour of recreation, and this is supposed to be to protect you. So you have a known rapper right now, Meek Mill, who's in prison on a violation of probation. And because of his notoriety as a rapper, rather than put him in general population, they put him in solitary confinement to protect him from other inmates. But while he's in solitary, he's losing his mind. So how are you protecting him? What protection is that? And let me remind you that 90%+ of people who go to prison are coming out. Do you want somebody, the taxpayers paying their money to have somebody incarcerated, put in solitary, lose their mind or their life through suicide, which is most of the suicides happen in solitary, and then come back into the community and be worse for it? Do you want somebody living next door you spent 10 years or 7 years in solitary confinement, they released them from solitary confinement back to society without therapy, counseling, education, without a job waiting for them, without a transitional plan set up? And they do it every day. Every day somebody's being released straight from solitary confinement to your community to work around you. And they're worse. They're more resentful. They've been hurt in them and abused in themselves, and they want to take it out on somebody else. But you're going to blame them when they act out on what's been tortured and visited upon them. That's not a public safety. You don't save people by making them worse off than they were before they went in there. It's indisputable proof that psychologically within 14, the reason why we asked for 15 days is because the international community, which the United States General Assembly, the United States signed on, said more than 15 days of torture. So somebody right now could throw a bomb and kill hundreds of American soldiers, and they couldn't spend more than 15 days in solitary confinement. But if I talk back to a correction officer, I can do 2 years in solitary confinement? Is that right? We signed on to that treaty, to that rule, the Mandela rule, it's affectionately known as. Yet we have people in 3 decades in solitary confinement. I just was with a woman whose husband been in solitary confinement. This is his 15th year. Why were we doing that to people who eventually we're going to have to release? See, we forget that. It's not lock them up and throw away the key. It's lock them up, mess them up, and then send them back out. Is that what you want?
You're hearing the remarkable story of Jerome Wright, who is an activist, a solitary confinement survivor himself, and the upstate organizer for the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement. And they're working with the Rock Axe Criminal Justice Task Force, and you're hearing a number of local churches also get involved. And so the conversation this hour is about solitary confinement and the priorities we have, the value judgments we make, and the impact on people like Jerome Wright. Listeners, if you want to call the program, you can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. It's 263-9994. Michael writes to us and says, I've heard that being in solitary confinement for an extended period of time can severely damage your eyesight because you don't get a chance to focus your eyes farther than 12 or so feet, and when you get out, you can't focus at that far distance anymore. Is that true? I don't know if that's true. I don't know how much that's been saying. How are your eyes?
They're not 20/20, and I heard that's not even perfect vision. But I can tell you, you will get your eyes will get messed up from that the type of lighting that's in there, that fluorescent light that you're staring into and looking at all day. You don't get enough sunlight because that 1 hour of recreation is not guaranteed every day. And it's not always an hour. On a good hot day, it may be half an hour. On a freezing cold day, it may be an hour and a half because they want to mess with you. I'm sure there are physiological things that happen. It's proven that within 4 hours, a young person under 21, brain begins to change. It's true that grown-ups, after several hours in isolation, begin to change physiologically. Their minds begin to change. And then prolonged, long-term, you have all type of issues, anxiety, depression, associative disorder, dissociative order, all type of things. Somebody who goes in marginally with a mental health issue will definitely tip the scale. Somebody who doesn't have one can acquire one. We put pregnant women and postpartum women in it, and I know, not being a woman, but being around women, that they're emotional creatures who need to have, interaction with people to let some of that stuff out. I could imagine a woman losing her mind in that cell. It happens all the time.
All right, so listeners, we did reach out again to the Department of Corrections for New York State, and they declined to participate in today's program on this, but they did send a statement in which they wanted to point out that the department continues to reform the use and conditions of solitary confinement based on a comprehensive settlement with the New York Civil Liberties Union. They write to us, since 2016, there has been, in their words, this is their characterization, an impressive 29% reduction in the number of inmates serving sanctions in a special housing unit cell, solitary confinement, and a 25% decrease in the average length of stay in solitary confinement. They write that the governor has directed the state in his State of the State address to consolidate 3 additional units, which will lead to more than 1,200 solitary confinement beds being removed through the implementation of a historic settlement agreement. And they say, as of today, all 3 units have been consolidated. So they are pointing to data which shows a change in direction here. And again, Jerome, I certainly wish people like Mike Powers in the Union Head. I want to have this conversation. I know the pastors embrace this. I would wish someone from the state could do that. But
so why do you think that if they have this indisputable evidence and data that they would not sit down and defend their data? I'm sitting here to defend the position of the people who suffered under this and who this is being visited on, to tell you that there is no change in anybody by sending them to solitary confinement for a year, 6 months, for something that they probably shouldn't be in solitary confinement to begin with. I'm telling you that we're ruining people's lives, we're decimating communities by doing this, and it's not making it safer in the prison or out the prison. So if you send me solitary, I do something, I go to solitary confinement. I do my 2 years in there, and then you let me back out. What has changed? What has changed? I got angrier for being in there, more resentful.
But I don't want to interrupt Jerome, but I want to say again, we reached out to a number of different constituencies, and I want to take a phone call from John in Hamlin, who has a different view on this. And we'll go ahead and take that now. John, thanks for calling. Go ahead, sir. Oh,
yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a different take on this. It sickens me to turn on the radio. I listen to NPR often, just to get another perspective. It sickens me to hear the ranting of a convict talking about prisoners' rights. When we have murderers and rapists and school shooters and terrorists who talk about their right to, well, let's see, they have 3 square meals a day. They have cable television. They have access to take college courses. They, as it turned out in New York in that prison break, they can cook for themselves if they're good. Now, these were murderers who cooked for themselves, and that's how the tools got shuffled in. This guy's talking about solitary confinement and how bad it is. I'm glad it's bad. I can't believe that there isn't more of it. And I can't believe that people get out of prison. He was saying, yeah, you want them to go solitary and then come out and live next to you? No, they should never get out. If you're a murderer, a rapist, if you've had a serious crime like that, you should never get out. I'm astounded that you can kill somebody and be out in 15 to 20. Hey, their life wasn't worth much. I'm still living and breathing. I'm okay on taxpayer dime. I think that prison should be much more ruthless, much more vicious, and very much more deterrent to keep innocent people innocent and safe. It shouldn't be what this guy's talking about. He has no rights. He has no rights at all. And as far as I'm concerned, it should be a very scary place. People should not think that they can get away with having civil rights once they destroy other people's civil rights forever. What about the victims? We always hear about the criminals, coddling the criminals. Conjugal visit, the governor set up. You can go have sex on the taxpayer dime. It's incredible. And that's all I have to say.
But, John, will you stay there? Can you hang on the line for a sec there?
Yeah, I can hang.
All right, please do, because what I want to do is I want to work through your thoughts on this in good faith here. And I'm glad you called, because I know certainly, John, your feelings are not alone, and I want to listen to what all of our guests have to say to that and have a conversation about it. Pastor Scott Austin, I'll start with you from Artisan Church. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I mean, I certainly want to remember victims, and their lives have been decimated, as the caller said. My concern as a pastor is, of course, with questions of theology and the fact that every human being is made in the image of God. And my belief is that it's possible, no matter what somebody's done, to be restored, and that the goal of prison should include a chance to restore someone to society. Simply shunting them away and keeping them out of everyone's life may feel better for us. It may satisfy a sense of vengeance that we all have. But in my mind, again, speaking as a pastor about theological concerns, it does not communicate the heart of God for human beings, and it does not provide any kind of a picture of redemption, which I do believe is possible.
Okay. Pastor Nikoloff.
I think one of the unfortunate parts of having to be a Christian, if that's your religion, is having to listen to what Jesus had to say. We make the Gospels kind of the center of our life and our understanding of God. And unfortunately, Jesus said some pretty hard things, like love your enemies and pray for them. Turn the other cheek instead of using violence. And one of the clear commandments of Jesus, which we don't have to like, but it's there, and again, I'm speaking to other Christians, is visit those in prison, proclaim release to the captives. Jesus visited all sorts of guilty people, and I think if we need any other prodding into why we should care about these issues, in a few weeks, it's Holy Week in the Christian church, which is the celebration of Jesus's most important work. And Jesus accomplished this most important work on the cross, not as a billionaire who makes giant buildings or someone who owns assault weapons or as a pastor, but as a convicted criminal who died in the company of other criminals and gave them up until the last moment the opportunity to have access to the kingdom. And so the fact that the incarnation of God in our faith system chose the form of a criminal to liberate humanity, whether, I'm not saying we have to like it or feel good about it, but I do think it should disrupt and call into question what we think of as justice. I don't like that picture of justice. I would love to see oppressors. I would love to see people who ran concentration camps run off this earth. And I would love to see people who are violent towards GLBTQ folks punished severely and people who go against my value system. But the kind of kicker is that none of us is God. And the revelation that at least in our faith tradition that we share is a God who says, you don't have to like it, but you do have to pray for your enemies and forgive those who hurt you and also visit those in prison instead of isolating them.
So let's do this, because I saved Jerome's response for last, because, I mean, Jerome is here and John had some very pointed things to say, but let me ask John if he wants to respond to what the pastors had to say first. Go ahead, John.
I would, and I do agree with what the pastor said in general. Vengeance is mine, thus saith the Lord, and I understand that we're to pray for our enemies. You can pray for those who are being severely punished in prison. I guess what I'm talking about is, yes, God has vengeance, and when we die, we will all stand before Him. And if we don't have the Lord, we're going to be in trouble, in my opinion. I do understand that. However, I'm talking about setting up earthly justice systems to create a severe deterrent to vicious and violent crime. Vicious and violent crime is on the spiraling upward for a lot of us who are paying attention. We hear that
It isn't, though, John. It isn't. Violent crime in this country is on a marked decline over the last 20 to 30 years.
It's on a marked decline except for the large school shootings. But if you take one life, let's say you take the life of a child. I won't get into the pro-life debate, but let's say you just shoot a child, like in a school shooting. Jesus said it would be better than to cause one of those little ones to stumble. It would be better if they had a millstone hung around their neck and they were basically drowned in the sea or never born. And so when you have these murderers killing children, yes, God is going to completely have vengeance on them. I'm not talking about that. And I am saying we should pray for them, but I'm still for capital punishment. We can pray for them as they're being strapped in the electric chair. Pray for them to have a reborn again, regenerate soul. But I'm talking about earthly justice and the lack thereof. He's talking about too much solitary confinement is too mean. Well, I disagree. I also don't think they should have conjugal visits, cable TV, weightlifting privileges, college courses, the ability to sue their prisoner. It's getting out of control here. I don't disagree with the pastors from a Christian perspective. I disagree with the notion of, hey, let's have these bleeding heart prisoners come on and tell us how bad it is in there.
So John, I'd like to ask you a couple questions before we turn over to Jerome here. I feel the anger toward school shootings, people taking the lives of children, people who I understand that. And what I want to offer is at least this question for you. Would you, because clearly you're not comfortable with releasing some people who are incarcerated ever. It sounds to me like you're saying they shouldn't be released. And okay, so I'm listening. I understand that. But where do you draw the line? Because some people who are incarcerated committed violent assaults that were not murder. Some committed different crimes at sort of different levels. It's not all school shootings. And I'm curious to know, first of all, do you have in your own mind a line that you draw on knowing that some people who are incarcerated have to be released and they will be released? You cannot keep everyone incarcerated forever. I'm curious to know where the line is for you.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you for asking it. I think that unless we sat down and tried to rewrite the justice system code, the line is really, I guess I'll have to draw it by saying if you raise up violence against others, whether it's attempted murder, attempted rape, attempted assault. A couple of years ago, there was this Wilding game where young youth would stand on the street corners and just punch old people and almost kill them. Once you cross that line, right, you should never, ever have the possibility, even remote, to repeat is done or to be in and among the people. We have to keep innocence safe, and we are not doing a good job of that. If you look at the history of parole, how many violent crimes, how many repeat offenders have been accounted for when the person has been released and was on parole? Can you answer that for me? That's my line, I guess, to answer your question and to ask you one back.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question, and it ties into our questions about why recidivism, the rates are what they are, and how we would reduce that. Because what we do know is our current system does not work very well. Our current system does not really do much in terms of rehabilitation or restoring. It is much more based on punitive. You've heard Jerome describe some of the disposition of people in that system. That's not casting with a broad brush on everyone, but you're right, John. I mean, we should all want the recidivism rate to be zero. I don't disagree. And that's partially, by the way, why some people say, look, if we have a system where we don't incarcerate everyone indefinitely, we have to care about what happens to their lives and who they are when they are not incarcerated anymore. And we're not doing a good job of that right now. And I don't know that.
No.
Okay. Okay. Because here's an email
I agree with what you're saying in that way. I just think that punishments do not fit the crimes in this nation. I take their life. And you would have had kids and grandkids, so I've just slaughtered a whole future family. Hey, I get 20 years, I can get out. I can hold down a job. I can have a family of my own. That's not fair. That's not justice. God's going to have vengeance, but I'm talking about a system on earth because we all have to walk around and have some sense of reason. There are no crime and punishment matches, in my view. We're way too soft on crime in this country.
Right,
and that's, I guess, why it got my... higher up, and that's all I have to say, really.
Okay, John, thank you for calling, and I want Jerome to respond. Go ahead, Jerome.
Yes, please stay on the line, or at least keep listening. John has every right to have the position he has, and I understand that. That is a position a lot of people have without knowledge of what's really going on. I emphasize, this is not a prisoner issue, because this goes on in the county jails where a person hasn't even been convicted of a crime can go to solitary confinement. I'm not trying to stop this to let people who are committing violent acts in or outside of prison out, doing this to stop people from being tortured that don't need to be tortured. You can go to the county jail right now for DWI. You didn't kill nobody. You didn't even crash. You just got pulled over. And you can go to the count in the holding center, and they can decide they want to put you in solitary confinement for any number of reasons or to protect you, and then you have to be tortured for those hours. That person doesn't deserve that. And when we talk about murder in this country, you don't even want to get into the murder debate with me about how this country has murdered, has genocided whole ethnicities of people, and nothing's happened to people for it. But that's not the issue that I'm here to talk about. I'm talking about you wanted people to come back into your community who are going to be released and not have anything done to them, not have them helped in any way. You're a Christian. At least that's what I think I heard you say. You espouse biblical principles. One of the pillars of Christianity, and I'm not trying to compare myself to Paul, who was a murderer. You listen to the words that Jesus took him and walked with him and trained him. So he had forgiveness for everybody. And if you really a Christian and you forgive everybody and you try. Listen, I live every day with the fact that I killed somebody. I don't just out here running around having a good time. I have to eat, live, and sleep with the knowledge that I did that. That's why I work so hard now to save other people's lives and turn people's lives around so one, they don't make the mistake I did. Or do what I did, and two, so they're not tortured like I was, so that they can come out and then hurt somebody else. So I'm not doing this for no self-aggrandizement or anything. I'm doing this because I have a responsibility for what I did do to change things. And this system is not broken. It's working the way they want to. And if you took the time to read some other material, then you would know about the whole conspiracy around mass incarceration and how it just segues from abject slavery into this, and a lot of people caught up in that. You got people who would have died had they were convicted of murder, and DNA now says they didn't rape or harm anybody. They've been in jail for 20, 30 years. So you would have just had them been there forever, regardless, and they were innocent. So, I mean, we know you. It's easy to get emotional about this, but let's look at the facts. The facts remain that people go in and are going to come out. What do you want coming out? You want somebody who's been in solitary who has no regard for you or anybody else because of that experience? Or you want somebody that goes in, if they find themselves in solitary, get some help so that when they come out, they're not revisiting that on anybody. Is that what you want? Or do you just want retribution on everybody?
All right, John, 30 seconds. Go ahead, sir.
I guess if they're going to release people, as he says, right out of solitary into your neighborhood. Yeah, that's a scary notion. And to that end, he says he murdered somebody. He's out. He's talking on a radio show. I'm sorry, but I think that's too many rights. I don't think he should be out.
I'm a human being, John. I'm a human being, and I have rights as a human. I'm not talking about civil rights. I'm not talking about civil rights. I'm talking about as a human being. I have, as a human being, I have a right. I have a lot of rights as a human being. And exercise, and one of them is the right to free speech that you enjoying right now.
Okay, okay, guys. Let me just say this, because we're about to lose the program.
Forfeited your rights when you killed somebody. I'm
all right.
Sorry.
So, John,
thank you for letting me know.
John, please, please call again. Thank you for calling. I appreciate your phone call.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's John. And here's why I appreciate that. That phone call is going to elicit a lot of emotions from listeners on all sides, mm-hmm. and I'm already seeing it via email. I'm hearing another phone calls I don't even have time to take. And what I want to do is continue listening to one another. So, John, I'll say it again. Thanks for calling. And I want to thank our guests for being here. And I want them to tell you one more time, if you want to learn more about what they have put together in this campaign, there's a couple things going on. Pastor Nikoloff, first of all, what's going on?
So at our community, the Southwood Mission on 125 Caroline Street, we have a solitary confinement cell set up along with the soundtrack of what it's. It's a very immersive, full body experience, opportunity to experience solidarity, empathy, and also hopefully get involved yourself. And the times it's open are today from 5 until 9, tomorrow 11 to 1 and 5 till 9, Saturday from 12 until 4, and then Sunday from 1 until 4 and 6:30 to 8.
Okay, that's how you can experience what solitary looks and feels like. Again, the pastor making a good point. You know in a few minutes you're going to be out, but if you want just to kind of get that visceral experience, it's at the South Wedge Mission. And Pastor Austin, what's coming up on Saturday?
Our Rethinking Incarceration event with Dominique Gilliard, an author of the book by the same name, and special musical guest Danielle Ponder, at which we can examine some of the theological things that I think were behind John's perspectives and how the church's theology has contributed to this culture of mass incarceration. That's 6 p.m. at Artisan Church, 1235 South Clinton Avenue on Saturday.
Pastor, thank you for being here. And Jerome, who is with the campaign, and the name of the campaign is the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement.
Yeah,
thank you.
I just want to say that March 13th, we're having a rally in Albany. I'd like people to come out, and March 7th, a training here.
You can find their campaign online. Thank you, Jerome. Yes, thank you for being here.
No,
All right, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.